So you never had a crisis of faith?
I don't know. I don't know what that means. Like, are you saying, like, did I ever say, is there a God?
Well, it's just like, I thought it was the one true church with exclusive authority, and now I don't. And, I thought there was a God who loved me who had 10 fingers and 10 toes, and now it's just some nebulous blob, if there's something there at all. Like, this whole dissolution of your worldview to the point of major disappointment and disorientation.
You thought
you were going to a certain place in heaven. You knew that there was an afterlife. You knew that you'd be in the celestial kingdom. You know, that whole identity was wrapped up and tied for many, you know, in the doctrine and theology and how they perceived it. And so when the doctrine and theology dissolved, sometimes everything else dissolves with it. And right. I'm not hearing you say that was your experience.
No, I mean, you know what killed me was Prop 22. I mean, like, that's kind of where my crises of faith came, was like, what is going on in this tradition I love? Why of all the times I could be born, you know, into all the faith traditions in the world, there's all the bars in the world, she had to walk into this one, you know, like, right. You know, like, why did God make me this way? Why did God make me with this huge heart, this huge mouth, this load of words, this curiosity for ideas for this moment in Mormonism? Thanks a lot. This really sucks.
Right.
You know, what am I supposed to do with this now? Where am I supposed to go? Why is my church, like, I mean, and so much of it's just been so elemental and heart-centered for me. You know, like, it was right after, you know, I know it's skipping ahead a minute, but, like, you know, the hardest part of my faith journey so far was the years in between Prop 22 and Prop 8, which are, Proposition 22 was in 2000. It was the year I got married. I mean, I know we'll go to that subject soon, but that was the first time in California the church had, you know, kind of really leveraged itself into a public anti-gay marriage card. They'd done it in Hawaii and Alaska. And it felt like someone had ripped my heart out of my chest and dropped it on the ground and dropped a cinder block on my heart. That's all I know how to describe it. And I could not go to church for 5 or 6 years without crying. I just every time I set foot in a Mormon church building, I'd cry. It was ridiculous. It was so, I mean, it just got comical after a while. And these are the years I had, you know, I was a young married and I had my babies. And so, like, I didn't have an impetus to get my butt back in church. I was taking the sabbatical, but literally, I mean, it was like, I'd be standing in the foyer, shaking hands, introducing myself to the bishop for the third time, right? Being the less active, right? Crying, you know, and they're trying not to see me crying. And it's all just ridiculous. And finally I was like, okay, God, really? This is really how you want me to spend my Sundays? Like, crying? I feel like it was, I was, okay, time out.
Right.
And I retreated and I was living in Austin, Texas at the time. And, you know, I just, the hardest part about for me has been, you know, I didn't even know if I deserved to call myself a Mormon. I didn't even know if there was really a place for me in my own home tradition. You know, I didn't know if I deserved any claim on the tradition at all. It was just those feelings of, like, social exclusion, theological exclusion, right? That the church, the culture had faced the prospect, these incredibly potent feminist prospects of our own theology, and just shut them down. Just shut them down. You know, and that was just who I was, and that was the moment I was living in, and that my Mormonism had been shut down centrally, institutionally. It was still living on the margins, sort of, you know, but where was I to go? Where was I to give? What was I? Who was I supposed to be now? That was how I experienced my crisis of faith. It was just like, not. It wasn't about God. It was about, like, where's the love? What do I do?
Right. And is that the end of your arc, your faith arc?
No, see, because then I had daughters.
So tell us about deciding to marry your husband.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, you know, I'm... it was love at first sight, which was funny, because I was, you know, at this graduate student party in Venice Beach, right? You know, and had met all sorts of interesting people, and none of them felt like home to me. You know, because I was labor organizing, I was meeting all sorts of eclectic, intellectual, pinhead, pointy, you know, crazy, radical types. And in he walks, And I took one look at him and I said, oh, I know who he is. He's a nice Jewish boy from Orange County. You know, he had the same watch and the same, like, coat that all the, like, nice little Jewish boys I'd grown up with had worn. And I was like, who's he? He looks like home to me. You know? I wanna... So anyway, you know, and so we, you know, David and I dated for a couple years. And again, you know, really, really hard on my family because marrying in the church is such an important deal. Such an important deal. And... Mm-hmm. You know, we were in love. And I had tried to date Mormon men, and I'd, you know, and a lot of Mormon men didn't want to date me. I mean, I was in trouble. It's a mess, you know? Not a mess in a personal sense, but like, you know, and I'd witnessed, you know, so many of the couples I saw at BYU who got married and then had, you know, liberal Mormon folks who proceeded into their faith crises in the early years of their marriage. And I saw some of my friends like move away and like just wash themselves of all relationship to the church at all. And like not even tell their natural born kids that they were from like Mormon stock, you know? Right. And I was witnessing the ways my friends were living out this like really difficult episode in the church's history and how it reverberated all through their personal choices. And I had this gut feeling that with this incredibly kind, compassionate, spiritual, totally non-threatened man, that I would have an opportunity to seek some answers, you know, continue to seek answers in a way that wouldn't hurt anybody. You know, he wasn't afraid of my search. He was willing to come along with me on it. Does that make sense?
It's a strong man.
He's a good dude. So we got married. And,
in a temple or?
No, a museum. And the first part was a stake president. And the second part, the first part of the ceremony was performed by a stake president. The second part was performed by a female rabbi. The stake president did the vows and she did the ring ceremony, which is like the kind of the traditional heart of the Jewish ceremony. Do people ever read things on Mormon stories?
Sure.
Because, you know, I knew you wanted to talk to me about David, and, you know, I pulled out this little thing I wrote, this part of an essay I'd written. I've written a series of essays about interfaith family life, so it kind of helps contextualize what was going through my head about choosing to marry him.
Go for it.
All right. To my family, my choosing to marry David meant I was choosing not to be with them in heaven. For me, choosing David meant placing my trust in a God bigger than doctrine. It meant choosing my joy, my best friend, my chance to create a family, choosing all of these as indivisible elements of my own spiritual well-being. For years, I believed that if I were a better Mormon, if I waited more patiently, had milder thoughts, a tamer spirit, if I were just better, God would reward me with a good Mormon husband. Then one Sunday, when I was 25, I found myself in a chapel full of unmarried Mormon women who also believed that if they were better Mormons, waiting more patiently, with milder thoughts and tamer spirits, God would reward them with good Mormon husbands too. Most of the women, they were nearing 40. One night, my Mormon bishop said something very wise to me. He said, "We often ask God over and over and over again what it is we should do, but sometimes we just have to do and seek God in the process." So I did. I chose not to bet on waiting. I chose my complicated self. I chose my true love. I chose to say yes. I know the importance of sacrifice. All the great religions teach that going without, giving something up, or saying no can make us more holy. But so can saying yes. Yes, yes to love. Yes to marriage. Yes to babies. Yes to outrageous sweetness. And yes, even to heartbreak. Yes, I love you, Mom and Dad. Yes, I love you, ancestors. Yes, I love you, baby girls. Yes, 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 yes. Like a glass breaking under my bridegroom's heel, I gave way and said to God, yes, do with me what you will.
Beautiful.
So I gave up. I married a nice Jewish boy.
Did you step on the glass?
He did.
He did?
Yeah.
Well, that's beautiful. That's wonderful. Thank you for reading that.
That kind of, that helps you. That's the map of the spiritual thought that went with that decision.
Right. Well, was he raised a believing Jew or a Reformed Jew or a secular Jew or?
He was raised Reform, and then his parents actually, when he was in his teens, started a Reconstructionist synagogue in Orange County. And Reconstructionist is a really interesting, it's like Reform on steroids or super vitamins, you know, Reform with more intellectual and cultural content.
Is it fair to say that Reformed Jews, you know, just don't believe any of it, but they just like the culture?
Oh, for lots. I mean, I think, you know, I'm hesitant to generalize, but I think if one studies the history of Reformed Judaism, I think the Holocaust was a watershed for Jewish folks, Jewish civilization, especially the Reformed branches, in terms of belief. You know, I mean, ever since then, I think there's been a much more cautious approach to making great claims and positing great claims. A lot of Jews just relate to, you know, they believe in God, isn't it? God is being kind of, if there is a God, God is, you know, expressed through the most divine aspects of human nature. You know, they don't believe in a God that parts waves anymore, because that God wouldn't have let 6 million people die, right? You know? So, yeah, I mean, a lot of Jews are either agnostic or atheist, don't know what happens after this life, don't need to know. But, you know, a lot of emphasis on memory, on family, on tradition, on goodness, and on deep ethical obligations to other people.
And yet they still want to maintain, you know, sort of self-identification as Jews.
Yeah.
They want to maintain the identity. They even want to maintain some of the rituals. Is that right?
Yep. It's great to be Jewish. It's a beautiful, you know, it's a beautiful tradition. It's a learned tradition. It's a very rich, very old tradition that's capable of sustaining a lot of diversity, you know, and a lot of Jews feel a deep tie. Although, you know, Jewish community is under pressure like any other community, especially within the last generation. A lot of assimilation is taking place, a lot of intermarriage. There's a lot of concern in the Jewish community about, you know, losing some of those cultural ties, but I'm not too worried about it.
Right. And so how did having daughters change the curve of your Mormon arc, and how have you and your husband talked about how Mormonism might or might not play into your children's lives and your family's future, or do you just not know yet?
Oh, yeah, no. It's an open topic all the time. You know, I think so much in my life changed when I crossed over from thinking of myself as a daughter to kind of taking ownership of my responsibilities as a mother, especially in regards to faith. Because, you know, then it became not about, like, how have I failed my parents? How have I failed the tradition that made me, and became more about what do I want to give my children, you know? And I remember being very pregnant with my oldest, Ella, and sitting in a room in my house in Texas when we were living there in the early years of our marriage. And the room had been like our office, right? It was this little two-bedroom house. And the room had been our office, and we were cleaning it out to make way for our nursery, right? And I had this big box of all of this documentation I had kept from the purge years, right? Like the 92, 93, all the hard stuff. And I remembered, you know, and this was now, you know, I had Ella in 2003. So this is like 10 years worth of stuff, right? And I remember compiling all this stuff, all this paper, you know, stuff related to Celia's case, stuff related to September 6th, stuff after that, Levina's case, all of it. And I remember compiling it in this kind of shell-shocked sort of way, saying, well, if I ever go to a church court, if there's ever a church court held for me, I may need some evidence. You know what I mean? Just this, like, really burnt, sad, depressed, kind of, like, defensive, worried, anxious place. And I remember having this box and, like, trying to make space in this office for the arrival of my daughter and deciding, I'm going to throw most of this away. I'm only going to keep what I want her to know. I'm going to stop keeping records as if I have to protect myself and start keeping records as if I'm building a legacy for my daughter, right? And I weeded out everything I thought I needed to defend myself in case someone came after me, this Mormon feminist. And I kept only the things I wanted her to remember, right? And not in this way of like purging the past, but in terms of like, I don't want to have to defend myself anymore. This is now about her. This is about passing on a legacy that means everything to me. What do I really need in this journey? What does she really need? She doesn't need my bitterness. She doesn't need my sadness. She needs knowledge. And that, you know, and that kind of, that's just kind of emblematic of the shift having my daughters meant to me. It's like, it is less about now, my questions could be less, there was less energy to indulge this question of like, did I, you know, I'm a bad daughter and what is my place and does anyone understand me? To, I'm a mother. This means everything to me. I'm passing it down in whatever form. I am taking responsibility for passing the best parts of Mormonism down to my kids. So that shifted everything, you know. That made me want to go back to church full time, you know, if I could. I'm still not there perfectly, but, you know, my daughters brought me back because I want to pass it down to them as much as possible in my way.
So your daughters have been in primary?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're in the primary program this fall. I was very proud. I keep waiting for them to pipe up and say something awful, but, you know, like, you know, talk about Heavenly Mother and just freak everyone out. Because, I mean, you know, in our house, Heavenly Mother is just, you know, hello, duh. In the heavens, are parents single? No. The thought makes reason stare. Hello.
Right. So
yeah, no. Yeah, no, they call themselves, they say, we're Mormon and Jewish.
Right.
You know, and they know how to pray both ways. That's really important. Teaching them prayer is really important because prayer has been the biggest, you know, most consistent part of my spiritual life. And they know how important it is to pray, know how to pray for answers. And they know how to pray a Mormon way. They know how to pray a Jewish way. I taught them how to say the Shema, which is, you know, like Reformed Jews don't usually say it. But if there is a Jewish bedtime prayer, it's like the Shema, right? Shema Israel. Now I'm going to forget it now that I've been recorded. Shema Israel. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, right? And they know how to say the Shema. They know how to pray Mormon or Jewish. They prefer Jewish because it's shorter. And I browbeat them. I'm like, yeah, but Mormon's more useful. You're going to, like, dig for answers with the Mormon prayer. And, you know, and my oldest is six, and we've, you know, I've taught them just, I've homeschooled them, really, you know, most of what they know, even though they've gone to primary, I take full responsibility. I sing them, you know, hymns in the rocking chair at night from the time they're infants, you know, my favorites. And the old school ones that no one sings anymore, like In Our Lovely Deseret, you know,
right,
which we should all sing. So they have a robust sense of their Mormon identity. They really do. It doesn't map perfectly onto the institution, but, you know, and I'm preparing them. They know that they're going to have to make their own choices about how to live their faith because the world doesn't know what to do with little girls who think they're Mormon and Jewish. But I'm teaching them how to pray for answers, and I'm hoping they're going to figure it out. In some way that will no doubt horrify everyone, but so be it.
Right. I don't know how you'll take this question, but I have to ask it because I was eating a hummus pita and the question came to me. As you now have however many years you have of wisdom and insight and perspective into how organizations work and how adults are and maybe even how leadership is, how tough leadership can be. I'm sure it's not a picnic being a department, head at a Division I university. Do you look back on the whole Sunstone, September 6th, student review, academic freedom thing, and ever say, I wish we had approached it differently? Not because you did anything wrong, not because you have anything to be ashamed of, but because you feel like you could have been more effective?
Oh, yeah. But first of all, I'm a Mormon woman. I have no idea what being effective within this institution could ever mean. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
An institution of what does that mean? You know, I mean, like, you know, if you're a Mormon man and you just do it right, you know, someday you'll work your way up the system. Well, yeah.
Right.
That's never going to happen. Like, effective is schmective, you know, like, I got homemaking night. Peace out, you know? So, I mean, so, you know, yes and no. I mean, one thing I always look back on and kind of scratch my head about and wonder, I mean, you know, part of this was my own really independent disposition, right? Was, you know, I'm like, why didn't I find my way under the cover of some mentoring? That would have been good. You know, like, mentoring from somebody who knew, like, how to weather giant institutional identity crises. And first of all, and I kind of sit back and I'm like, why didn't someone, I mean, and I remember a couple of really good instances of mentoring I got, but they weren't covered. They were kind of like, hell yeah, sister, this thing's blowing up. We don't know what to do. You know,
like, so Eugene England wasn't sitting you down saying, now, Joanna, we have to work within the process. We have to...
No, see, he never had that mentoring relationship with me. I mean, you know, I went to his house a couple of times and kind of worshipped like everyone else did, but I never had that personal one-on-one. And part of it with anybody, I think, even Cecilia, and I think part of it was that I'm sure I just seemed really competent to everybody, right? Because I was, you know, straight A, super overachiever, yada, 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 always with a ready word about things. And, you know, I'm sure I just seemed competent and no one knew, no one had the wisdom to kind of say, yeah, she may think she's, you know, she's pretty sharp, but she's 19 and there's some pretty serious historical business happening here and she might need some cover and some, like, you know, no one ever kind of looked out for me like that. And that's all right, you know, I mean, so, yeah, I think it could have been done differently, but never in terms of effectiveness. I would have just liked a little more wisdom in terms of how to survive it. And I think that's been the tough thing for Mormon liberals has been, you know, the generations before us, they go, you know, like, you know, they have their credit and they've gone, you know, like the older, you know, the generation of feminists who survived the ERA, you know, there were some of those women who were around still, you know. She's super exceptional though, but like.
Who is that?
Carolyn Pearson. Oh, okay. I mean, but who was there to tell us?
Right.
Decides to have a gender spasm again.
Right.
Who was there to tell us?
Right.
How to survive that. So I don't look back and say, gee, I wish I would have been more effective, would have channeled it better, said it politer. Those pathways have never opened to me. But how to... protect yourself and have a little bit better historical perspective on the way that Mormonism does have a really hard time with gender, you know, and it comes around historically, you know, time and time again, and how one weathers those things. You know, I finally got around to reading Mormon Enigma last summer while I was at Hedgebrook on retreat. I finally read it, and if I would have read that when I was younger, that would have helped a lot. But,
would have helped.
Yeah.
How did it help?
Well, you know, it is no new thing to be a Mormon woman and to feel a bit, you know, put out by what's going on inside the institution.
So you'd have felt some solidarity with your sister Emma.
Well, I just would have felt, I would have known that it was no new thing. And that many Mormon women who were deeply in our tradition had experienced what I was experiencing. And that was just part of this legacy.
Right.
It's just part of it. You know, and I think that's what a lot of us who make it out the other side just realize. It's like being part of this tradition is not a cakewalk. Right.
Right.
Especially if you find yourself in one of those historical moments where our people are going through something. Especially if you're a woman or gay or really kind of inclined to think identified with those marginal positions, you know? Sure. But you can't, that is part of being Mormon. That is part of our tradition. It comes around and around. It's not the end. It's part of the experience.
Right. So, as you think about, you expressed this sort of revitalization of your Mormon, your feelings towards the church, sort of a reactivation, taking back and owning the direction, a positive, empowered approach.
Mm-hmm.
Does that leave you any room to still hope for some change or for some things to get better, either within the church or just the culture? Or are you just totally separated from and disassociated from any type of aspiration for the church or for its members now?
Oh, yeah. What is the scripture? All God asks is you to do justly and love mercy and to walk in fear and trembling before God. I don't have aspirations for the church on purpose. God's in charge here of all of us. God knows what he's doing. Again, my timing historically is so lousy. I decided to go back to church to attend, right? Not to return to Mormonism. Never left Mormonism. Never. Never, never, never. Even when people said to me, oh, someday you'll leave the church, you'll feel really good about it, in a nice, kind, counseling way, I was like, no, you're crazy. I'm Mormon. But decided to go back in January 2008. What happened 6 months later?
Yeah, Prop 8.
My timing is so good, And again, it's the same feeling. My heart was ripped out, thrown on the ground with a cinder block. And I cried for 6 months. I was angry with everybody in my heart, of course, never out loud, ha-ha. But
right.
Couldn't go to church. Because it really did infiltrate. I live in San Diego. Hello. This is not I do not live in an urban university ward. Right. It was everything. It was in every aspect of the conduct of, and it's still, there's still reflexive. It's there. It really was a big part of the fabric of Mormon life for a significant period of time. It was very difficult to have any contact with the institutional church and not do Prop 8. And I remember walking around the block and crying and walking my dog and just praying and just having this sense come over me that God is on both sides of this story. There is no way around it. God is at work among Mormon people. We are working something out amongst ourselves. This is really painful to me. I can't be near this right now. I can't take my kids to this. It really upsets my husband. This is not good for people like us. It's not good for Mormon liberals. It does not help us feel at home in this tradition. But God is at work here, and God is at work amongst the gays, and God is in charge here. And this is really painful. And I prayed for comfort one night. I was really tired and really upset about it all. And I had this really wonderful dream that helped me feel a tremendous sense of promise and hope and relief. But I don't have any specific notions of things to do to implement in Mormonism to make it work. Now, I think, what has made all the difference to me are spaces like this, and the amazing thing we didn't have, 15 years ago, an online community of Mormons who are willing to provide cover and home to one another as we go, survive and witness these different historical episodes that can be really painful. That's really crucial. This is a crucial thing,
Maybe we kind of have the mentors that you never got to have at BYU.
Yeah. There's just so much more access and continuity of experience and community, I think you're right. Either we have the mentors or we're going to be able to be the mentors.
Right.
I mean, we have great examples. You know, you look at people like, you know, the Bushmans and, you know, just bright, faithful people who have weathered a lot and done it with incredible grace, you know. But, you know, a lot of the folks in the generation just above us have again, followed that path where you're either really careful to stay very orthodox in your expression or you leave.
Or you bolt.
Right. And what if one life goes through many cycles? Can we still be at home with one another as Mormons with that kind of, you know, diversity of experience? I think we can. I think the tradition is rich enough and beautiful enough to sustain a diversity of experience. Maybe not in the institutional church all the time and every moment evenly. I'm not saying it's not there. It is there. But maybe not all the time evenly. Does that make sense?
Sure. Sure. So, I didn't joke with you, but I said something that you thought was a joke when we talked about doing this interview. I said, we've all been waiting for you to come back. And and what made me say that was, you know, when I went through my disaffection, I Googled your name. I mean, this is before Google, but I'm like...
Well, you Googled me.
Well, I mean, it would have been Alta Vista or something back then, or Lycos. But I mean, I was like, if there is Mormon activism, Joanna's at the head, and I didn't find you. And I, you know, every year I'm like, where is she? Where's Brian?
I was I was crying in Austin, Texas, sorting through boxes full of crap about the purge.
Yeah, so when I saw your article on Glenn Beck, and then I listened to you on Radio West with Doug Fabrizio, I'm like, whoa, she's back. And so I contacted you, but you know, tell us what you're doing now. And
I have to say, when you said that to me, that was one of the nicest things I've heard in years. I can't tell you how it warmed my heart, that feeling. It was like homecoming. It's like that scene in like Man's Search for Happiness where they steps through the veil and there's all those people in white. I hear you say that. That was like that for me. That was that good.
It's like a medley, like a track and field race. It's almost like you kind of passed the baton on to some of us, and now we've come back around the track.
You guys are so good with it.
We're ready to pass that baton back. How's that?
Oh, dude. Okay, yeah, I'll grow a third arm, and I'll pick it. No, you know what was crazy? One of the major things was seeing the Mormons on PBS.
Yeah.
And, you know, my friends who were close to me, and again, you know, so many of my close friends since coming to graduate school and then kind of like setting out on a life path, since I've been kind of in and out of Mormon communities, even though my faith has remained consistent, you know, I move in a world of non-Mormons all the time. I do not live in a Mormon world, like a homogeneously Mormon world. You know, I have very close, you know, and so, you know, so many of my close friends knew this was this big, big, big part of my life, but I wasn't able to articulate it very well. And, you know, watching the Mormons, I like, you know, and seeing how much time in the second section of the Mormons they gave to those difficult years, the BYU years and the Purge years. And, you know, just sitting there with David watching it and saying, that's my friend, that's my friend, that's my friend, that's my friend. I mean, Helen Whitney interviewed me, you know, like, I never, you know, I wasn't on it, but like, I realized I belonged to this history.
Right.
You know, it was it's a hard stretch of history, but I belong here. This is my part of the story. And it caused me to just kind of think. And, you know, I switched jobs. I moved from University of Texas, which was a really research-intensive school, to this other, you know, to San Diego State, which is less so, still very respectable. We got a spousal hire. We came home, you know, went surfing. Hooray, you know.
Right.
But started writing again and realized how much I'd missed that, writing creatively, nonfiction. I wrote a whole book about interfaith family life. Got a literary agent, shopped it, got a great sniff from a very good press, and then they said, oh my gosh, you're a terrific writer, but you're a Mormon, and that's so weird. I'm like, okay, hold up. Is it not 2008? Like, please.
Right.
You can still say that to people. You know, like, come on. And so I was, you know, grumbly in my head for like 6 weeks, and I was thinking about it, and, you know, and I was like, you know, if someone can still say that in America in 2000, you're a Mormon, that's so weird, it's time to tell the story. It's really time to start telling the world what it feels. Our stories are not out there enough.
Right.
People don't know. We don't know how to talk about ourselves. Mormons are terrible at talking about ourselves in public. Look at Mitt Romney. Could not talk about Mormonism in public to save his life.
Right.
And so I started writing down, over the course of a year, all these like memoir essays, the stories I delight and horrify my non-Mormon friends with that convey a sense of like how awesome and, distinctive and wonderful and rich our, and sometimes horrifying our culture is, and our tradition is. So that was the genesis of the Mormon Girl Project, and that, that hunger and writing those, it felt like I was finally doing some of the work I was meant to do, So I'm making a comeback.
So you're writing the Great Mormon novel.
The Great Mormon memoir.
And
no hubris, please.
Oh, right. I'll have the hubris for you. And then you've got this new column, blog, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Ask Mormon Girl.
So what's the website?
The book is going to be called either AskMormonGirl.com.
Okay.
Ask me your questions.
Now, is that for non-Mormon audience or for a Mormon audience?
Yes.
Both.
Of course.
Okay, it's not just for non-members.
No.
Okay.
Not at all. No, I have found myself so many times in this strange journey, like, I am always the only Mormon the people I'm with have met and felt like they could have a conversation with. I'm hanging out with like African American folks. I'm hanging out with gay folks. I am the native informant, right? What do you people actually, can you explain this to me? And I can, and I am not ashamed, and I am not defensive, right? And that's just something the life experience of the last 15 years has given me. And so, the book will have Mormon Girl in the title. And so kind of like, working my way back into this practice of talking about Mormonism in public in ways that celebrate its beauty, celebrate its strangeness, celebrate its hominess, and, are honest, too, about its tough parts. That's who I want to be. So that's Ask Mormon Girl. So my first question was literally out of the blue. I'd started this Ask Mormon Girl Gmail account and like published this, the Glenn Beck piece and a few other things in Religion Dispatches, and seriously from nowhere comes this query from this kid. And I've graded like college essays for like 15 years now, so I have a pretty good sense of when someone is writing appropriate to age and tone. And literally this kid, 15-year-old kid, I'm a 15-year-old, I'm Christian, I have a crush on a Mormon girl, like, what should I do?
Right.
Oh, okay. The universe has sent me the cue that it's time to begin the Ask Mormon Girl column. So I have a whole series of queries lined up right now. Everything from like, really? Mormon liberals? They exist? To like, I'm a non-Mormon single woman, 50, living in Salt Lake City. What do I do?
Right.
So we're just going to have fun with that.
And you're cross-posting on Mormon Matters, right?
Yes, the wonderful Mormon Matters.
All right. Yeah, you've gotten some good attention there. I mean, the thread depth is like 40 or 50 after only a day. That's pretty good, by the way.
Well, there's this, I try not to read the comments because they're crazy, especially, oh my gosh, if you go to like the Glenn Beck piece on Religion Dispatches, I mean, just a symbol of how, I'm sorry, Bass Ackwards American culture is in regards to Mormonism, like, anytime I write about Mormonism anywhere, people, posters, if you go deep into the comments, just have these spasm outbursts. Funny underwear, angels, golden plates, blah, 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 blah. And your point is, like, people cannot talk rationally about, like, this giant segment of American religious history, this huge population. I mean, there's as many Mormons as Jews in the United States.
Right.
People do not know how. It just confounds me, And so, there is much space for all of us to get out and tell our story in all of its beauty and unapologetically and honestly and to really, scrutinize it. So, but the comments today at the column, there was one woman who thought I was being really condescending, and I sure didn't mean to. I'm not worried about her. Sure. The kid who wrote me the query liked my answer, so that's all I know. I told him the group date.
Right.
He's 15. He's not allowed to single date anyway.
And to burn couches. So, all right, I'm going to get you out of here on this. You ready?
Yep.
I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a chance to be aspirational a bit.
Oi.
If you had to paint a little picture, and it doesn't have to be dramatic or radical or, you know, if you wanted to just paint a little bit of a picture of what type of Mormon experience your daughters might encounter, let's say 10 or 15 years from now, in ways that you think would be pleasant or exciting or heartwarming. Can you sort of take us to the mountaintop? You know, you're at the Lincoln Memorial and you have a dream. Can you sort of paint a picture of the type of Mormonism that maybe your daughters will be able to experience?
Ooh, that's so hard. I feel like I'm predicting a future that belongs to them alone, you know?
That's good.
I don't want to predict it.
That's an okay answer. Keep going.
Well, you know, I mean, I want them to know how to pray, right? And I think I'm biased, but there's something about the way I've learned to pray as a Mormon that has brought me so much joy and so much comfort that I want them to know how to pray like that. I want them to know how to seek answers. I want them to know how to draw on the strength of a tradition that says, yeah, you go into the woods and you find answers. That's where the answers are. You go into the woods. You go cross the plains. You go seek. And you do it alone. If you have to go alone, if you have to pull a handcart because you don't have an ox, you pull a handcart, you go. You go in search of your answers and you seek them, you know. And you don't be afraid. And you know that God is out there and it's going to carry you. I want them to go to Temple Square and sit in the tabernacle and look at those hand-painted pine columns and feel the commitment and ingenuity and vision of their very common ancestors who helped build this beautiful, curious, unique American tradition, and just to take a lot of joy in it. And I want them to celebrate Pioneer Day with a big, crazy group of whoever they've encountered on their journey. That's what we do that here now, you know. I've reclaimed Pioneer Day. We make funeral potatoes and everything.
With a calico dress.
We wear bonnets. I make frog eye salad. We wear bonnets. I 2 weeks before Pioneer Day, I whip out the Ward cookbooks I've collected over the years and horrify my Jewish husband with how much cream of chicken soup and Cool Whip we use as people and Jella. So I want them to celebrate Pioneer Day. I want that to become a big diasporic Mormon holiday. I want them to know they can always come home to this tradition. That's what I want.
Beautiful. I want pictures the next time you celebrate Pioneer Day.
I want you to come celebrate Pioneer Day with me.
All right. I'll
bring family.
I'll save up my teaching assistantship money.
Yeah. Okay. We'll come to Logan. I'll bring the frog eye salad.
I'll spy the Cool Whip.
Yeah.
Joanna Brooks, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us on Mormon Stories. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
When I was a boy each week, on Sunday we would go to church and pay attention to the priest. He would read the holy word and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. And when I was in Sunday school, we would learn about the time. Moses split the sea in two. Jesus made the water wine. And I remember feeling sad. Miracles don't happen still. Now I can't keep track. Cause everything's a miracle. Everything, everything, everything's a miracle. Wine from water is not so small, but an even better magic trick is that anything is here at all. So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, to finding where there isn't one. Holy water was rare at best. It barely wet my fingertips. But now I have to hold my breath. Like I'm swimming in a sea of it. It used to be a world half there. Heaven's second rate hand me down. But I walk it with a reverent air. Cause everything is holy now. Testament, that'd be very hard to say. See another new morning come. Say it's not a sacrament. I tell you that it can't be done. This morning outside I stood. Saw a little red-winged bird shining like a burning bush and singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things have changed since then. Everything is holy now. It used to be a world half there. Heaven's second rate hand me down, but I walk it with a reverent air, cause everything is whole.